A hospital for the people being exterminated? Selections on incoming transports are not the only mode of gas chamber selections which have been claimed. A Dutch Jew, Dr. Elie A. Cohen, was arrested in 1943 for attempting to leave the Netherlands without authority. In September 1943, he and his family were shipped to Auschwitz, and he was separated from his family, which he never saw again. He later wrote a book, Human Behavior in the Concentration Camp, based on his experiences as a member of the hospital staff at Auschwitz I. Because Cohen's contact with the people who were being exterminated was of a doctor-patient nature, it was necessary to produce an extraordinarily descriptive term for his book, and objective was as good a choice as any. Cohen interprets certain selections in the hospital as selections for the gas chamber, quote, "After the HKB, camp hospital, administrative room had given warning that the camp physician was about to make a selection, the whole block became a hive of activity, for everything had to be spick and span while everybody stood at attention. He made his entry with his retinue, SDG, medical service orderly, block keltista and block clerk. The sick Jews were already lined up, as a matter of course, naked. Simultaneously with the presentation of the card with the personal notes concerning each prisoner, to the camp physician, the block physician, in whose ear the diagnosis was being whispered by the room physician, introduced the patient in question to him. In 90% of the cases, the card was handed to the SDG, which meant death by gassing for the patient, unless the political department gave orders to the contrary, which frequently occurred in the case of Schutzhaftlinge, people charged with ordinary crime. Not only emaciated prisoners, but also some who looked well fed were sometimes consigned to the gas chamber, and occasionally even members of the HKB staff, who were officially exempt, had to suffer a similar fate. Therefore, especially when one considered the medical style of the camp physician, it was generally supposed that it was not only people incapable of work who were scheduled for killing, but that the decisive factor must be that a certain number of persons had to be gassed. Officially, no one knew what the final object actually was, not even the staff of the administrative room, for after the names of the gassed, the initials SB, short for Sonderbehandlung, special treatment, were placed," unquote. Cohen does not report having seen any gas chambers. The only evidence which he draws on to support a gassing interpretation of such scenes, such interpretation certainly not being evident from the raw facts, consists in the post-war claim of extermination at Auschwitz, and also in that there were rumors inside the camp of extermination somewhere at Auschwitz. The existence of such rumors is practically certain, because a delegate of the International Red Cross reported their existence among British POWs at Auschwitz III in September 1944. However, nothing much can be inferred from the existence of rumors, as rumor spreading is an elementary aspect of psychological warfare, and we have seen that the OSS and, of course, the communists engaged in rumor spreading and black propaganda. In fact, knowledgeable officials of the US government have admitted the information spreading. At the Farben trial, prosecuting attorney Minskoff asked defense witness Munch the following question about gassings at Birkenau, quote, "Now, Mr. Witness, isn't it a fact that, during the time you were at Auschwitz, Allied planes dropped leaflets over Katowice and Auschwitz informing the population what was going on in Birkenau?" Unquote. Munch did not know that. Minskoff was knowledgeable in this area, because he had been a foreign operations-oriented lawyer in the Treasury Department during the war, and was presumably well informed on WRB matters. The WRB had collaborated with the Office of War Information on various leaflet operations. The head of the prosecution staff at the Farben trial was Dubois, who had been general counsel of the WRB, who wrote that in his, quote, office in 1944, he knew what was going on at Auschwitz, unquote, and who chose in his book to reproduce with general approval the part of the testimony containing the Minskoff question. This is good evidence for an American leaflet operation over Auschwitz, although the method seems somewhat crude. My guess is that, if the leaflets were indeed dropped, they were dropped at night and in moderate quantities. Actually, a leaflet operation was not necessary to get rumors going in the camps, for the highly organized communists were very active in this area. Their superior organization, which involved systematic illegal listening to radios, had made the other inmates essentially fully dependent on them for quote-unquote news. Let us remember that it was a small world, even in 1939 to 1945, and that, on account of the general ease with which information flowed into and out of the camp, a fact noted on page 131, the Allied stories about the camps would have ultimately and necessarily penetrated into those camps by various routes. The Red Cross delegate mentioned above had attempted to visit the Auschwitz camps, but apparently got no further than the administrative area of Auschwitz I and the quarters of the British POWs. The latter were the only persons the existing conventions entitled him to visit. With regard to other matters, the German officers there were, quote, amiable and reticent, unquote. The delegate reported without comment that the British POWs had not been able to obtain confirmation of the rumors by consulting camp inmates. It is claimed that, despite these rumors, the British POWs who were interrogated by the Russians after the capture of the camp, quote, knew nothing at all of the crimes, unquote. Subsequent events have, of course, changed the rumors into quote-unquote knowledge in many cases. Incoming Jews certainly had no suspicions of gassings. With the selections, we are offered another fact for dual interpretation. There is no doubt that the extensive industrial and other activities required selections of people for various conventional purposes. We are then asked to add an extermination purpose to these activities. Before leaving Cohen, we should note that there were sick emaciated Jews, as well as others, in the Auschwitz I hospital. He further informs us, quote, the HKB was housed in 5 good stone-built blocks. There was one block for surgery, one for infectious diseases, one for internal diseases, one for Schonung, less serious cases, and block 28, X-ray, specialist rooms, medical experiments, admissions. The sick lay in 3 bunks, one above another, on straw mattresses, and were dressed in a shirt, with, later, a pair of drawers added, under 2 cotton blankets and a sheet. Every week the patients were bathed, and every 2 weeks they were given clean underwear and a clean sheet. There were few fleas and no lice. Each berth was seldom occupied by more than 2 persons. But even patients in a state of high fever had to leave their beds to go to the toilet, or to wash in the cold lavatory in the mornings. Because of organizations from the SS, there were always medicines, though not in sufficient quantities, including even sulfa drugs. These had been brought in by large transports of Jews from every European country, unquote. He adds that hospital conditions were much worse in other camps, about which he has only read. The Auschwitz I hospital was obviously no luxury establishment, but nevertheless it showed a serious concern, on the part of the Germans, for the recovery of inmates, including Jews, who had fallen ill. This observation also opposes the claim that those not fit for work were killed. Cohen reports certain selections of an incompletely known character, in connection with unknown destinations. It may be that those considered of no further use as labor were sent to Birkenau. This would be very reasonable because it has been shown that the unemployables from the Monowitz hospital were sent to Birkenau.